I wanted to say a few words of introduction, and I didn't prepare anything to say about this story. It's from a tribute anthology for Jack Williamson. And as most people here already know, Jack Williamson was one of Fred's principal collaborators. We just heard the story Brad Denton read that was a collaboration with a posthumous Cyril Kornbluth. And Fred has said that Cyril and he were almost like twins born from different mothers, that they thought alike. They weren't the same age, but they had similar life experiences. I think Cyril was slightly more precocious than Fred, although Fred was extremely precocious. Fred and Jack had what I think is probably their most successful long-range collaboration, second only to Fred's collaborations with Cyril. Jack was about as different from Fred as you can imagine somebody being. Fred from the Northeast and urban, and Jack from the Southwest and not just rural but ranch. Fred was a bright early success, publishing when he was still a teenager and an editor when he was still a teenager. Jack was a late bloomer, as he describes himself in his autobiography, Wonder's Child. So in some ways they were very, very different, and they brought different life experiences to collaboration. They were even over a decade apart in age. And I think that being close to somebody in age does make a difference in the way you look at the world. Having similar external experiences impinge on your life. Fred has sometimes been described as sardonic. Jack, self-described again from Wonder's Child as chronically gloomy, although the Jack that I knew was always sunny. It's amazing the disparity between what a person says about himself and how he appears to the rest of the world. And despite his sardonic writing, I think Fred is eternally optimistic. So maybe there's quite a contrast, but in many ways I think they merge. As a late bloomer, Jack always was very deliberate about his writing, and he made many notes, and he wrote, and then he rewrote, and then he revised the revisions, and he rewrote again, sometimes struggling over a single word. And Fred, although he started out schooling himself to write publishable first draft copy, whip it out of the typewriter and send it off to an editor, now rewrites and edits. And I think his years of editing experience have made him an incredible editor. He is a very, very excellent editor of his own work, which I can attest to, having read drafts that have long passages crossed out that are perfectly delightful passages, but the lack of them strengthens the work. He is just an amazing editor of his own thought. And then after he gets done with that, he'll revise it again and tinker with it. And so he's sort of turned into Jack in some ways. This is the Mayor of Mare Trank, and it's an alternate history. The incident that changed young Johnny Williamson's life took place in Arizona in the year of 1916. If it had just rained a little more in that bad, dry year, Johnny's father, Sam Williamson, might have made a go of the farm, but it didn't. The soil dried. The seedlings withered. The crop would not be made. Sam just let the dust flow through his fingers and made his decision. Dryland farming was too chancy to feed a family. something had to be done. His first thought was to move on to some more hospitable area, Texas, or maybe even Old Mexico, where it did sometimes rain. But he didn't have to. His neighbor, the Republican Party boss of the county, made him an offer. He would give Sam a job in his general store if only Sam would put his name in as a candidate for the Congress of the United States. That wasn't meant as a serious prospect for a career in government. The boss only wanted a name to put before the voters in order to complete the ticket with no real chance of being elected. Big Bill Bronk, the Democratic incumbent, was well known to be unbeatable in any election. However, fate intervened. The day before the election, Big Bill Bronk was shot to death in the parlor of a county seat brothel. And when the votes were counted, Sam Williamson, with his wife and children, was on his way to the Capitol. The city of Washington, D.C. was a marvel to Sam's boys, young Johnny and his brother Jim. They had never been in a big city before. The storefront moving picture shows, the clanging of trolley cars in the streets, the hordes of people rushing on about their business. The boys blossomed there. It wasn't all to their good. The city was a lot more fun than school, and sadly, they both developed a talent for playing hooky in order to explore the wonders of the metropolis. Happily, that didn't much matter, because they were both bright enough to breeze through their classes in grammar in high school. When Johnny was 18 years old, he graduated from high school as valedictorian of his class the week before his father died. That was a terrible blow to the family. They were left with no reason to stay in Washington and only a congressman's pension to feed the young family. Johnny's mother decided that their best bet was to head west for Texas, where cousins had land outside of Dallas and ranch living was cheap. That didn't solve Johnny's problem. He was ready for college, but where was the tuition money to come from? However, in the event, the problem was no problem. Representative Blakeless of Ohio, formerly Sam Williamson's closest associate on the Fish, Game, and Poultry Subcommittee, was ready and willing to give his late colleague's boy a congressional appointment to any service school he chose, and young Johnny selected the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. At the academy, Johnny stopped playing hooky. He thrived at the point. He paid attention to his studies, lived by the cadet code, and walked off his demerits until he stopped getting them. He turned out to be a first-class cadet. When he graduated fifth in his class, he was privileged to pick his own branch of the Army service, and what he chose was the fledgling Army Air Corps. Those were bad years economically. The stock market had collapsed and the country was groaning under the weight of the Great Depression. Money was scarce everywhere, even for the military, and the equipment of the Army Air Corps showed it. The slow, cranky biplanes that the Corps was flying belonged to another obsolete generation. Every airman knew that the sleek new planes the Germans and the English were practicing with across the Atlantic could outfly and outfight any of them. Accidents were frequent and often terminal, but Second Lieutenant Williamson was lucky and skilled, too. He took to flying like a duck to water. He became an instructor, then a check pilot for the new P-36s that were coming in, and then war broke out in Europe. Pearl Harbor changed everything for Williamson as well as for everyone else. He was one of the first fighter pilots sent to North Africa and quickly showed he was one of the best. The 10-year lieutenant became a captain, then a major, commanding a squadron. He had four clusters to his air medal, and his confirmed kills amounted to 11 by the time of VJ Day. He was one of the few urged to stay on when most of the Army, Navy, and Marine Corps were demobbing. By the time he reached his 20-year retirement, he was a full colonel and possessed by a new ambition. John had been in London at the time of the V2s. He had sneaked across the channel to Peenemünde to see the place where those rockets came from, and he had been struck by the thought that those same rockets could take something, maybe even someone, into space, and he wished with all his heart for that to happen to him. So now a civilian, he went to work for an aerospace company in Texas, doing his best to make sure that if ever someone tried to make that great leap into the unknown, there would be machines available to make it work. He thrilled when the new president, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, made his speech about putting men on the moon. It was his chance. Slim, yes, but a lot better than no chance at all. And so Williamson instantly began to call in old favors. His former seconds in command were now colonels and generals. He begged them to get him into the space program. And they tried. They really tried. They pulled all the strings they could for their old boss, but time was against them. Colonel John Stuart Williamson, retired, was 53 on the day when Kennedy made his historic speech, and that was simply too old. His dream was over. His prospects of getting into space were exactly zero. That is, they were until the events of November 1963. What brought John Williamson into that city that day was his brother's little son, Gary. The boy was as dedicated to the idea of space travel as his uncle, and a devoted admirer of the president who was going to make it real. What Gary Williamson wanted more than anything else was to see his hero, and maybe even to take some pictures with him with his new movie camera. By the time they got to a point where the presidential procession was going to pass, all the good places were taken. But John Williamson was up to that challenge. There was a kind of warehouse building by the side of the road, apparently unoccupied at the moment. Williamson tried the doors until he found one that would open, and he and the boy climbed the stairs to look out on the street. They found a good window at once, but there was a tree seemed to be in the way. Williamson left the boy there and scouted some of the other rooms, and in one, the third one, was startled to see a scruffy man with a rifle glaring angrily down at the street. It could have been something innocent. It could even have been, Williamson thought later, a Dallas detective in plain clothes guarding the route of the procession. He didn't stop to think of any of those possibilities. Reflexes took over. He charged the man, knocked the rifle out of the window, overpowered the would-be assassin, and was sitting on his chest when a pair of actual Dallas cops, alerted by the sight of a rifle falling out of the window, came pounding up the stairs to take charge. That night, Williamson and his nephew were called to see the president on Air Force One. Mrs. Kennedy was there, looking sweet and appealing in her pink suit and pink pillbox hat. So were Texas Governor Connally and his wife. So were a couple of Secret Service men, amiably but carefully watching every move Williamson and the boy made. The president got up from his overstuffed chair, grimacing with some sort of pain in his back, and extended a hand to Williamson. "Colonel Williamson," he said, "they tell me you're the one who took out this fellow." "Oswald," his wife supplied. "His name is Lee Harvey Oswald." "Yes, Oswald. I don't know what kind of a shot he was. My Secret Service friends tell me that we would have been a pretty tough target to hit." "A damn impossible target," Governor Connally grumbled in the his first lady said sweetly. "Oh, not impossible. I'm glad we didn't have to find out." "But anyway," the president said, "it looks like you just might have saved my life, and maybe Jackie's too. I owe you, Colonel. Is there anything I can do for you?" "I want to go to the moon," Williamson said promptly. Kennedy grinned. "Can't blame you there, so do I. Well, put in your application and we'll... I did, Williamson interrupted. They turned me down. They said I was too old. But I have 1,800 hours, mostly in P-38s and P-51s, but some jets, too. And I believe I can handle a spacecraft whenever there's one to handle. And I know I can pass my physical, any physical they can give me. The president looked at him thoughtfully. I bet you could at that. All right, put your application in again, and this time write on the bottom that you have an age waiver officially granted by the President of the United States. Williamson did pass the physical. Williamson did excel in astronaut training. Williamson was the second one of the Mercury 8 to make a suborbital flight, and when the Apollo program reached the point of actually doing what President Kennedy had promised and putting a man on the surface of the moon, Colonel John Stuart Williamson was one of the three men strapped into the capsule as the giant Saturn V lifted off from Cape Canaveral. He was not, however, one of the landers. Williamson's job was to remain in the orbiter while Armstrong and Aldrin rode the lunar capsule down to the surface. It wasn't perfect. He would have preferred to be in on the actual descent. But it was one hell of a lot better than anything else around, and he accepted the assignment with grace and pleasure until the moment when the capsule was scheduled to take off again for orbital rendezvous. For all those hours of waiting in the orbiter, while Armstrong and Aldrin capered around on the lunar surface in their ungainly suits, John Williamson had worn round his neck a leather strap that held a small volume with complete pre-planned instructions for actions he should take in every possible emergency. Almost every possible emergency, anyway. There was one exception. At the planned moment of liftoff, Williamson was over the horizon in his orbit, out of sight of the landing area in Tranquillitatis. He could neither see the capsule nor hear the transmissions to Mike Collins at Earth Control at that second sidebar here. Mike Collins was the one who was actually in the orbiter. He didn't know what had happened until he rounded the curve of the moon. And by that time, he could pick up the messages, the situation had become critical. Tipping too far, said Buzz Aldrin's voice from the surface. Try again, urged the voice from Earth Control. Can't, said Aldrin despairingly. Looks like the soil's a little soft under the leg. We're already tipping from the vibration. If we go to full berm, we'll just tip this beast over on its side. That was when Williamson cut in. You can't get lift, he demanded unbelievably. Afraid not, Johnny, said Aldrin. We're stuck. Say goodbye to everybody for us when you get back. And that was one contingency for which Williamson had no instructions. In the event that the lunar module was unable to lift off, there was no easy way for the orbiter to come down to their rescue. And so the book did not say what to do, because in that case there was simply nothing to be done, or at least nothing that the people who wrote the book had been able to foresee. Colonel John Stuart Williamson, on the other hand, was not in the habit of doing nothing. He was a pilot. Stuff happened, but no matter how bad things looked, there was always something you could try, right up to the moment when you crashed or died, and that was all she wrote. But until that moment, you never gave up. So he did three more lunar orbits, keeping his camera on the landing module in its drunken, half-toppled posture every minute he was above the horizon, knowing that all around the world there were 2 billion people, now 2.5 billion, now maybe 3, as new ones heard what was going on and tuned in, billions of the Earth's people all watching the terrible scene on the lunar surface. Williamson's heart was heavy, but his mind was still racing. And when at last he started the burn that would lift him out of lunar orbit and start him on the long, slow fall toward reentry, he got on the radio again. "Earth Control, Earth Control," he said into his microphone. "Earth Control, don't stand around with your thumbs up your asses. Start figuring out what you're going to do for these guys." The time it took for an answer was longer than the normal couple of seconds transit time delay. Then Mike Collins, the Boston controller, said, "Hey, Johnny, cut that out. The world's listening to you. Don't get their hopes up when you know we can't do a thing." "I say again, Earth Control," Williamson snapped. "You don't want to waste any more time talking about what you can't do. You have to do something. You don't want to let them die there." The next pause was longer, and when the voice came on, it wasn't Michael Collins, it was the director himself, and savage. "Colonel Williamson, have you gone out of your tree? We can't rescue them. They're well and truly stuck." "Who said rescue? Just keep them alive. There are 2 more lunar modules and 3 Apollos at the Cape right now and enough Saturn V's to lift them. All right, you can't send another crew down until you figure out what went wrong, but you can send a goddamn capsule down, crewless, on automatic, and load it with air and water, lots of it, because you don't have to bother filling the tank with return fuel, and keep them going for a couple of weeks until you send another one down and another until you figure out how to get them home. You can do that all right. The only thing you can't do is let them die there." Would NASA have listened to what Williamson was saying if half the world hadn't heard it at the same time? Perhaps it would have, but also perhaps not. Perhaps organization and precedent would have carried the day, and the proposal would have been turned over to an assessment committee. And only then, a week or a month later, would a decision have been made to abandon the pair on the moon, to preserve the project's orderly schedule, or perhaps even to do what Williamson urged, though by then Armstrong and Aldrin would, of course, be dead. That didn't happen. Neither the controllers in Boston nor their masters in Washington had the choice. Within minutes, the phone lines to NASA were hot with loud-talking citizens demanding that the space agency send immediate help to the stranded astronauts. And so were the lines to the White House and to both houses of Congress and to every newspaper and broadcasting station, too, not just in the United States. The whole world was crying out to save the astronauts, and within the hour, the order went out to start pre-flight the next moon-bound Apollo. And of course, the rest is history. On any clear night when the moon is at quarter, everyone in the world can see the diamond dust lights of the community in Mare Trank, and everyone knows how it got there. How 12 separate missions brought air, food, and water down to Mare Tranquillitatis. How on the 7th mission, Colonel Williamson himself piloted the module down to the surface to become the 3rd man on the moon and to stay. How by the time the design flaws in the landing struts had been identified and fixed, there was such a wealth of materiel clustered around the original landing site, the Earthlight Trailer Park, one astronaut dubbed it, that it had become a de facto lunar outpost and before long a priceless resource. The next step in space travel was clearly the stars. The way to get there was clearly by nuclear fusion propulsion fueled by helium-4. And where else in the solar system was there a richer store of HE4 than the masses of solar wind had sown into the soil, into the lunar soil, atom by atom, over the 4.5 billion-year life of the sun? And then there was no question of who was the right person to head it. And so John Stuart Williamson became the first, and so far the only, loved and honored mayor of Mare Trank.